This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After the Republican Party's defeat last November, the party has been struggling to redefine itself. That's become more difficult in the wake of Senator John Ensign and Governor Mark Sanford's affairs, and a new Vanity Fair article about Sarah Palin that has set off a public spat within the Republican Party. The article by Todd Purdom described some former McCain campaign ads as believing Palin was not prepared to be vice president. What does the Republican Party stand for now, and who are its leaders? My guest, Dan Balz, is national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Dan Balz, welcome to Fresh Air. What do you think the John Ensign and Mark Sanford scandals do to the GOP brand, which for years has been identified with family values?
Well, it's at a minimum, Terry, it's an embarrassment. But it's an embarrassment that comes at a terribly difficult moment for the Republican Party. Their brand is damaged at this point, and I think anything like this, particularly the one that goes to kind of the heart of a piece of their message, further damages that. I think it does that in two ways. One is it discourages, if you will, the sort of the evangelical or social conservative base of the party. They wonder whether the people who claim to share their values actually practice those values. That doesn't mean those people are going to defect to the Democratic Party, but it makes them somewhat less enthusiastic about getting out there and really working for Republican candidates. I think the other thing it does is it just causes the party more problem with people who have already kind of turned away from the party, those independents and moderate swing voters that went heavily for the Democrats in both 2006 and 2008. It gives them even less reason to try to come back at this point.
Now, what about Ensign and Sanford themselves? Where did they stand on family values?
Well, they were both proponents. I mean, there's hardly a Republican, certainly a Republican who has won statewide and who may have national ambitions, who doesn't in one form or another talk that talk. And, you know, I don't think that either one was so heavily identified with that. I mean, certainly Mark Sanford is better known for his economic conservatism than his social conservatism. But they certainly bought into that. They spoke about it. They defended it. And in past, they have criticized others who have strayed in the way they have now strayed, particularly Mark Sanford did that during the Bill Clinton scandal of the 1990s.
And one of the things Sanford said then was he accused Bill Clinton of lying about the oath to his own wife.
Yes. And as we are seeing this week, Governor Sanford is continuing to explain his story in ways that are, you know, that suggests there's more ways in which he violated that marital oath and, you know, lied to his wife and put aside the constituents of South Carolina. So, you know, it's an embarrassment. Human beings are fallible. We all know that, and Democrats are as well as Republicans. But it seems to come at a somewhat higher price for Republicans because they have made that a centerpiece of what they stand for as a party.
You know, when I think of how the anti-gay marriage Republicans have based their position in part on their insistence that gay marriage will undermine heterosexual marriage, you know, it seems like some Republican elected leaders don't need any outside help when it comes to undermining their own marriages. What are you hearing behind the scenes in Republican circles about whether the family values agenda is going to work anymore and whether it's time for the Republicans to either reconsider their views on gay marriage or at least reconsider the argument that they use about, you know, undermining heterosexual marriage?
I don't think that the Republicans can afford to abandon the family values agenda. Now, we've seen people in the past few months, Steve Schmidt, who was a key advisor to Senator John McCain last year in the presidential campaign, has basically said the party needs to reevaluate its position on gay marriage. We know that younger voters are much more tolerant, particularly on gay issues, than older voters are, so that the Republicans, you know, they've got not just a short-term problem, but they've got a long-term problem in how they figure out how to address this.
So what are you hearing behind the scenes from Republicans about where the party is heading and how they want to get out of the trouble that they appear to be in now?
Well, I think there's several aspects to it. I mean, the first is clearly they have drawn some lines with President Obama on his agenda. I mean, they are betting, that the president's economic policies will not work as effectively as he hopes they will. They are betting that he is trying to push more government onto the public than the public really is prepared to accept. In addition to the size of the stimulus and the bailouts of GM, the bailout of GM we know is not particularly popular. The size of the potential deficit that is being run up, the health care plan that the president's proposing would inject government in a much more significant way in the healthcare industry. And the climate change bill that the House passed narrowly last week is another that has significant implications for the role of government. And then you put on top of that financial regulatory reform, which certainly I think a lot of people believe is necessary given what happened last year with the financial industry. But nonetheless, that's a lot of government that the president is asking for. I think Republicans believe that there is an opportunity for them if they can make a kind of a coherent case that he is doing too much, that he is putting too much government in place, that there will be an audience for that.
Let's look at the leadership in the party now. I mean, who are the leaders? Let's start with Michael Steele. He's the head of the Republican National Committee. Does he have any actual clout within his own party now?
Not a lot of clout. Although that's not that unusual for the chairman of the party. The role of the chairman of either the Democratic National Committee or the Republican National Committee is in many ways the primary technician for the party. They are the people who have to make sure that the party has fundraising capability, that its political operation is up to speed, that the voter lists and databases are constantly updated, that the state parties have the support they need. They are rarely the people who can speak for the party with great credibility. Now, Michael Steele has certainly had a rocky tenure as chairman of the Republican National Committee. So to the extent that he might have been a spokesman, I think he's hurt himself on that front. So no, Michael Steele is not the person who the Republicans are looking to be their spokesperson.
Who really are the leaders now within the Republican Party, either the public faces or the behind-the-scenes people?
Well, you look in two places. One is you look at the congressional leadership. These are the people who have been at least elected by their peers within the House and Senate. So you have John Boehner in the House, and you have Mitch McConnell in the Senate. Again, I would say that it's very difficult for a congressional leader to really be a national spokesperson for the party. So while both Senator McConnell and Congressman Boehner have a prominent role in articulating where Republicans are, it's very much within the context of a legislative agenda. And we know that legislative speak does not transfer well out into the rest of the country. The second place you look for leadership is in the ranks of governors. And the Republicans have some prominent and attractive governors. Governor Tim Pawlenty in Minnesota, who certainly has his eye on running for president in 2012, is one. Charlie Crist, the Florida governor, is another. He's going to run for the Senate in 2010. He's a big state governor. Haley Barbour in Mississippi, though that's a small state, Haley Barbour was the chairman of the Republican National Committee when Bill Clinton was elected in 1992 and helped bring the party back. Because of what happened to Mark Sanford, Barbour has now ascended to the chairmanship of the Republican Governors Association. And I think if not in the role of candidate for 2012, because there's some speculation about that, but at a minimum, I think Haley Barbour will be somebody who will be looked to by other Republicans for guidance, for strategy, for leadership. We know he is a smart strategic thinker. We know he's been through this before. He has the experience to provide the party with some balance and some ballast at a time when they've got problems.
Do you see any other governors as being either hopeful leaders of the party or hopeful presidential nominees?
Well, certainly Sarah Palin, the governor of Alaska. We don't know whether she's going to run again in 2010 for reelection, but she is certainly somebody who commands a significant position in the Republican Party. Not an uncontroversial one by any means, but I don't think there's anybody among the ranks of governors who has more charisma and who has a kind of a more passionate following. We don't know whether she can expand out beyond that, but certainly Sarah Palin is somebody that a lot of Republicans are hoping will run for president, and some Republicans are hoping will not run for president.
I really kind of half thought after the election that you would kind of officially enter the land of celebrity and give up politics and either like do a television show or just some kind of more celebrity oriented thing. But she's staying in politics.
Her future is very uncertain at this point, I think, but one that so many people are interested in. I don't think there's another Republican in the party who creates the kind of, you know, electricity that she does.
Do you see any splits in the Republican Party between the older and the younger generation of leadership?
Well, I think that it's not open warfare by any means, but there is great concern within the party, Terry, that there is an older generation of leaders who need to move off the stage. I mean, if you look at who we've seen over the last 6 months pushed forward by the Democrats or by themselves or by the media as potential leaders. I mean, first it was Rush Limbaugh. Now, Rush Limbaugh is who he is. I mean, he's a radio talk show host. He's not going to run for office, but he has been around a long time. But put him to the side. You've got Newt Gingrich. Gingrich, I say, still a hero to many Republicans for bringing them to power in the 1990s. Somebody who may well run in 2012 for the presidency, but also somebody who we know is a divisive figure, a polarizing figure, and has been around a long time. Former Vice President Cheney, who's been out very strong on the issues of torture and the closing of Guantanamo and a lot of President Obama's policies on terrorism. Some Republicans cheer what he has done, but others say it is time to have somebody else making those same arguments. So you've got this generation who have been in power or they've been on the public stage for a long time who, for the sake of the party being able to turn the page on all of that, need to be gently or hard way shoved aside. The problem that we've seen over the last few months is that in one way or another, the newer generation of leaders has not stepped up in an effective way. I mean, you can point to Mark Sanford and John Ensign on the one hand because of problems with their private lives, but you can also point to Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, who is a very bright and able person and probably does have a bright future. But when he was asked to give the Republican response to President Obama last winter, he did not. I mean, he just did a bad job, and everybody knew it, and he knew it. So the moment when Bobby Jindal tried to step onto the national stage, he slipped and fell. Sarah Palin has had her own problems throughout this year in establishing her political bona fides. And so there's lots of questions even among Republicans about that. You look at John Huntsman, an attractive Republican who might have been a comer in 2012 or beyond, and he's decided to go off to China to be the U.S. ambassador for President Obama. So the ranks keep thinning of the people who should be the next generation. So that has been, I think, particularly discouraging to a lot of Republicans that I've been talking to, because they think, well, we've got – who are our future leaders and how do we get them out there? And when we get them out there, are they going to perform?
Now, you wrote a recent article in which you said that a lot of Republicans are wincing about some of the things Dick Cheney recently said about President Obama and the president's approach to security and dealing with, alleged terrorists. But you say that Cheney is too powerful for Republicans to take him on. From what does his power emanate now? I mean, he is out of office. He's unlikely, I think, to run for office again.
Well, the people who would most like him to step aside tend to be the people who work hardest as operatives to win elections. And they have a sense of the public mood and the public's desire. And in their estimation, Dick Cheney is not a helpful messenger for the Republican Party of the future. But they are not of the stature that they can take him on. Elected officials are very unlikely to do that. I think that what you need is for elected officials not to say, Dick Cheney, go away, because it's very difficult to take on a former president or a former vice president if you're another Republican elected official, because you just run the risk of alienating at least part of your base, and you can't afford to do that, particularly if you have aspirations to run for president.
You know, I always wonder what Republicans, and I know you can't really generalize here because every Republican is different, but what Republicans think of right-wing talk radio and TV Take Rush Limbaugh, for instance. He says some pretty extreme, wild things. He's not running for office. He's not taking responsibility for running the country. He's a talk show host, and what he needs is an audience and ratings. And saying extreme things is very good for getting audience and ratings. And let me give you an example of one of the things that he said lately in relation to Mark Sanford's affair. He said, oh, well, this is almost like I don't give a damn. And he's talking about what Sanford might be thinking. You know, this is almost like I don't give a damn. Country's going to hell in a handbasket. I just want out of here. He had just tried to fight the stimulus money coming to South Carolina. He didn't want any part of it. He lost the battle and said, what the hell? The federal government is taking over. I want to enjoy life. So he's basically blaming the federal government and President Obama for an affair that started before Obama was even president. I mean, that's just example of what he said. But knowing that it's a talk show host's job to get ratings and not win elections, do you think the Republican Party, that a lot of people in the Republican Party see Rush Limbaugh and other right-wing talk show hosts who say extreme things as being helpful to them or harmful to them?
Well, the role of radio talk show hosts, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity, who's any number of them, has been an essential part of how the Republicans have expanded their voice, their message, and their appeal, and energized at least a part of the population. I think most Republican office holders see them as they are, which is that they speak to a part of the base. They do it sometimes in ways that are outrageous that elected officials can't get away with. But again, they're not prepared to take them on. They've got to work around them. Most of the people who want to be leaders of the Republican Party don't want to get into an argument with somebody who has an audience as big as Rush Limbaugh's, and we've seen numerous examples of that. On the other hand, most smart Republicans don't think you can get elected president of the United States by speaking the way Rush Limbaugh does. But Rush Limbaugh gives demoralized Republicans, some energy.
Some Democrats have nicknamed the Republican Party the party of no, because they're saying no to everything that President Obama opposes. But what do they stand for instance, on the economy or on health care, two of, the big programs that President Obama is pushing forward on?
Well, they stand for what they have stood for quite a long time. They stand for less spending. They stand for lower taxes. And on health care, they stand for a solution to this problem of the uninsured that would rely much more heavily on market forces. I think the problem for them at this point is that those views were well articulated, certainly in the 2008 campaign by Senator McCain and by many Republicans, and the country voted for something different. And so now the question for the Republicans is it adequate, is it simply adequate to basically say no to what President Obama is doing and in essence hope that his policies fail and that the public will then turn back in their direction? But I think, let's say that were to happen, I think they're still going to have something that they don't yet have, which is a new version of that set of principles. They've got to adapt that to a different time in a different country. Demographically, this is a much different country than it used to be. Geographically, things are shifting. And so the Republicans are speaking to a new audience, and they've got to find a voice for that new audience.
Well, Dan Balz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, you're more than welcome. It was a pleasure.
Dan Balz is national political correspondent for The Washington Post. He's the co-author of the book The Battle for America 2008, The Story of an Extraordinary Election, which will be published in August. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Senator John Ensign of Nevada and South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford have something in common, in addition to both being Republicans who confess to out-of-wedlock affairs. They're connected to a Christian group known as the Family or the Fellowship. Ensign lives in a house on C Street in Washington, D.C., that's registered as a church and is owned by a foundation affiliated with the group. In Sanford's press conference about his affair, he said he'd worked with C Street, which he described as a Christian Bible study group. Usually between 5 and 8 lawmakers live at the house on C Street. If you've never heard of C Street or the family, it's perhaps because the family prefers it that way. It's a pretty secretive group, but very powerful. The longtime leader, Doug Coe, was included in Time magazine's 2004 list of the 25 most influential evangelicals in America. Coe was described as the stealth Billy Graham, specializing in the spiritual struggles of the powerful. My guest, Jeff Charlotte, is the author of the book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. It just came out in paperback. Charlotte is a contributing editor for Harper's and Rolling Stone and an associate research scholar at NYU's Center for Religion and Media. Jeff Charlotte, welcome to Fresh Air. What is the family or the fellowship's idea of Christianity that it's trying to spread?
Well, it's a very unusual organization, so much so that some traditional Christian right organizations consider it heretical. It goes back to this vision that the founder, Norwegian immigrant named Abraham Verrady, has in 1935 in the midst of the Great Depression. And he believes that God comes to him first in the person of James Farrell, who was then the head of U.S. Steel. And Verrady was sort of at that time already prominent minister, so he was traveling in those circles, and reveals to him that the Great Depression, that all economic suffering is a punishment for disobedience of God's laws. So any kind of New Deal is not the way to go. And then God gives him a second revelation, which is that Christianity has been getting it wrong for 2,000 years. At its best, talks about the poor, the weak, the suffering, the down and out. And he believes that God tells him, very literally, using these words, Abram, your mission is to serve the up and out, those who are already powerful. And if you can get their hearts right with God, then they, in their positions of power that God has placed them in, will dispense blessings to those underneath them. One Senate staffer who had been affiliated with the group for a while said it, called it, described it, I think, very aptly as a sort of a trickle-down fundamentalism.
So the fellowship or the family, that's why it ministers to powerful people like congressmen and senators.
Yeah, absolutely. And congressmen and senators, foreign leaders, what they want is, in one document, says we are trying to build a family of world leaders who are bound privately through our networks with this particular understanding of Christianity. And that if we can just do that, we'll be able to, you know, bring peace to the world, free markets, which they equate with Christianity, and all these other blessings that they tend to also conflate with American power.
Now, what's the connection in the philosophy of the family between free markets, capitalism, and Christianity?
You go back to this moment in the Great Depression that I describe, where they see this as a sort of punishment from God for what they see as sort of a sin of socialism. The attempts to regulate the market are prideful. In other words, the invisible hand, they take that very literally, you know, the invisible hand of capitalism. They say what you have is an invisible hand through which God touches the hearts of corporate titans, leaders, and so on. And they then run their companies. And the family began primarily as a union-busting organization. That was their sort of first mission. They were terrified of organized labor in the 1930s. But they tapped into this older American tradition that really goes back to something in the 19th century called the businessman's revival, this idea that if you have Christian men of business and Christian politicians and so on, you don't need laws to protect the poor because they will protect the poor. It's this very paternalistic and potentially very dangerous tradition because, of course, it leads you away from accountability. If we say we don't have regulation, we don't have oversight, we don't have laws, we just have God operating in the heart of these powerful men, well, we're left without a lot of recourse when a powerful man like, say, Governor Sanford or Senator Ensign goes off the rails.
So what about the values agenda that has been so important to the Republican Party in the past few years? Does the family emphasize an anti-gay agenda, anti-abortion, pro-celibacy, pro-abstinence-only education, I should say? Are they supporters of that values agenda in addition to, you know, emphasizing the more capitalist approach?
Yes, but not rigidly and only secondarily. To them, the idea of free markets working through elites, building these networks of elites, that's the top concern. So Doug Coe, the longtime leader of the group, I sat in one time on a meeting between Doug Coe, the leader, and Congressman Todd Tehart of Kansas. And Todd Tehart was sort of there almost sort of auditioning to get involved in this thing. And he was trying to show off, you know, his dedication to those kinds of meat and potatoes, Christian right issues. And he was talking about the threat of Islam and talking about abortion. And Doug Coe, he doesn't necessarily disagree with this sort of line of thinking. He sort of nods his head and says, yeah, yeah, that's fine. But, you know, you're really thinking very small. He says, you know, this is just, these are our hot button issues. This is the real work of the kind of governance that we're after, is what he calls Jesus plus nothing. And Jesus plus nothing means actually Jesus plus everything. It means everything gets filtered through Jesus. And the examples he gave, he says, what does Jesus have to say about Social Security? In the family's case, it's privatize, which is almost always their answer, is to privatize. What does Jesus have to say about building roads? What does Jesus have to say about every single issue, including in your own life? And you organize men like Sanford and Ensign, and maybe Todd Tehart, into prayer cells so that they can ask, what does Jesus have to say about what's in my life? And they actually give veto power over their own lives to the other men in their prayer cells. That's their language, by the way. Cell sounds like an inflammatory term, but it's actually got this old evangelical pedigree that long predates the current association.
You compare the family to, say, televangelist groups, and you say that in some ways they're at opposite poles. Like the televangelists, they want to get on TV. They want to preach to a really large audience. They want a mega church. Whereas the family, it's pretty secretive. They don't want any media attention. They don't want people to know their name. Why?
This was this man that I mentioned, the current leader, Doug Coe, this was really his insight. And it goes back to 1966. He's the second person to lead the family. The longtime leader was a founder, Abraham Verhaeghe. And he didn't mind public attention. He really liked it to be known that he was hobnobbing with, you know, senators and presidents and kings and that kind of thing. He knew also that you had a media at that time that didn't look too closely into the religious lives of politicians. It wasn't considered that relevant. And then you get this moment in the late 60s where two things are happening. The family's really expanding its reach into governments around the world, sort of the developing world. And they're dealing with a lot more sort of unsavory characters. And at the same time, you have a media that's suddenly moving into one of these sort of great investigative periods where the media is sort of saying, hey, we're going to ask tough questions. And if you're going to go and pray with General Suharto in Indonesia and then make an oil deal, we want to know about that. Well, so Doug Coe sends out a memo to the various congressmen and politicians involved. And he says, the time has come to submerge our public image. They got rid of letterhead. He says, from now on, when you do something through the family, don't say you're doing it through the family. Just say you're doing it yourself. And that we're going to become invisible believing groups. This is their language. It's important because when someone says invisible, it sounds kind of conspiratorial. This is their language and their documents. They thought that would make them more effective. And I always try to see it from their perspective. They do think that, look, we can do more good work for people. We can help these powerful people if we can give them a shield from the public eyes. You know, and that's fine for a pastor and an individual, but when we're talking about political deals, it's a whole different story.
Now, you mentioned that I guess it was Doug Coe prayed with General Suharto, who was a strongman in Indonesia, and then made an oil deal. What are you referring to?
Yeah, that's one of the stories I really delved into and into these documents. The way I was able to tell this story, I should say, is for all its secretiveness, the family dumped 600 boxes of documents and hundreds of tapes in the Billy Graham Center archives in Wheaton, Illinois. And so I spent years going through these papers and so on. And you would find this sort of whole alternative history of the Cold War. So we know about U.S. support for Suharto, who came to power with the murder, it's hard to know, anywhere between 600,000 and a million of his fellow countrymen, whom he described as communists. Sometimes, you know, Suharto's forces would wipe out entire villages on the premise that everybody in them was a communist and had to die. I mean, he was one of the really great killers of the 20th century. And Doug Coe and Abraham Verhaeghe took a look at him and said, that's a man of God. And keep in mind, Suharto's...
Did they say that's a man of God or that's a man we'd like to make a man of God?
Better, good correction, actually. They didn't, neither. They said, that's a man God has chosen. And this is an issue that they always deal with. When they know that the dictators they're dealing with are often, you know, pretty scary guys, but they'll say, look, God chooses who he wants to work with. So God wants to fight communism. Suharto is a man who's fighting communism, and he's killing a million people. And, well, just look at the Bible, they'll say. The Bible is filled with, you know, blood and killing and so on. God works in mysterious ways. At the same time, they're reaching out to Suharto. They're bringing delegations of congressmen over there. They're bringing delegations of the oil executives who are financing their work over there. One oil man named Harold McClure wrote in a memo that was then circulated among congressional members that he'd had an hour-long meeting with Suharto and some of the oil people around Suharto. Suharto, of course, controlled the eighth largest oil company in the world at that time. And they had an hour of prayer, after which they moved on to business. And he said it had just been one of the most spiritual encounters of his life and also one of the most lucrative, which sounds deeply cynical. But when you understand the family's perspective, it's not. They see the wealth and influence and power in this kind of dumbed-down Calvinism way as a sign of their selection, or literally their election by God, that they've been chosen for this wealth, for this influence.
So did this Christian right group, the family, make money on the Indonesia oil deal, or was it not about money for them? I mean, the oil deal wasn't in their name. It was for another party. But, you know, what did they get out of it?
The family, it's never about money for the family. And I think this is important for secular folks and liberal folks to understand about fundamentalism in general and this organization in particular. They really believe what they believe. They believe they're working for God. This is not a cynical exercise. What they got out of it was the sense that they were helping Suharto do his work as God's chosen man for this country.
What is the house on C Street?
The house on C Street is one of the ways the family pursues its ministry of reaching out to powerful people and serving them. It's a former convent registered as a church, so it doesn't pay taxes, at which the family provides housing for anywhere at any given time, you know, 5 to 8 congressmen, usually at below market rate. So there's a bit of an ethical question there. And they also play host to many other congressmen who want to come by for lunch or just to hang out. Christian right leaders can use the house on C Street as a place where they can sit down in private with politicians and talk to them. They'll have prayer sessions. When I spent some time there, they had a calendar prominently displayed on the wall with instructions for daily spiritual war. So on Tuesday, for instance, you are to pray against the demonic stronghold of Buddhism. Wednesday, it's Hinduism that's the problem. Most of the guys who live there are a little more laid back than that. And the family doesn't require any doctrinal, you know, statement of loyalty. You want to live there and be in fellowship with these guys, that's fine. It's soft sell evangelism, not that kind of hard Bible thumping that you see on TV.
When you said that the below market rental rates posed ethical questions, did you mean that because the house is officially called a church and it doesn't have to pay taxes, it can afford to charge cheaper rates, and it's questionable whether it's really a church or not? Is that what you meant?
The whole deal. I mean, registering as a church so as to avoid taxes looks a little sketchy. You have these congressmen who are living in a church, but this is not a church by any recognizable standard. That seems like a tax dodge.
I've read there's a chapel inside.
Well, it's a former convent. It's kind of an interesting building. But it doesn't function as a church. And not only does it function as a church, but you have the leader of the organization, Doug Coe, who's going there. And Doug Coe will speak very openly against church. Doug Coe doesn't like church. He doesn't like that whole idea of Christianity as something that you limit to Sunday mornings. He doesn't like the idea of a church where the churches are, historically, they are about a sort of a bottom-up faith where everybody has equal access, right? But Doug Coe teaches this very different idea. He says when you read the New Testament, you discover that there are concentric rings of authority and that there's the masses and Jesus speaks one way to them and then there's the disciples and Jesus speaks one way to them. He says, well, that's true now as well. He says Jesus reveals himself more fully to his chosen And Coe believes, when he's not using the word chosen casually, they refer to themselves as the new chosen because they believe that the Jews broke their covenant with the God. So the Jews are no longer the chosen people. The family are the new chosen. And they don't operate through churches. So it's a little bit of a dodge there. And then there's also, I think this is a very minor question. I think it's easy to get distracted with the family by like ethical quibbles around the edges when there's this big, giant question of transparency and openness and democracy. But there's this ethical question of are these guys getting below market housing? And is this should this be registered as a gift, especially given that Christian right leaders are going there to lobby for this cause or that cause, and that there is unofficial lobbying going on in the house?
Although the family is a very secretive group, the thing that's best known about it, although I didn't know about it till reading your book, is that the family or the foundation created the annual National Prayer Breakfast, which is attended by the president, members of Congress, and important people from around the world. Can you give us the short version of how they created it, how and why they created it?
The why first was they wanted an annual ritual of consecration of the United States to Jesus. And they thought if they could install this right at the heart of American civil religion, they would be sort of slowly moving America to becoming this godly nation they wanted to be. So in 1953, working with Billy Graham and Senator Frank Carlson, who was an Eisenhower's right-hand man, they went to Ike and they said, we want to do this. They tried with Truman and FDR too and didn't get anywhere. And Ike immediately recognized it for what it was, which was a blatant violation of separation of church and state, didn't want to do it, but he owed Senator Frank Carlson, who was then one of the leaders of the family, he owed him a big favor. He had helped organize an evangelical vote for Eisenhower, and Eisenhower agreed to do it. And the family knew that once they got it rolling, then it becomes a tradition. And so now I've talked to congressmen. You mentioned that you didn't know that the family runs it. Almost nobody does. Your invitation comes on congressional letterhead. I've talked to congressmen who believe that it goes back to the beginning days of the Republic. You can imagine, you know, James Madison rolling over in his grave at the thought of this. It's a pretty bland event on the surface of it. You know, it's supposedly ecumenical, although their planning documents say, this one planning document describes it as, anything can happen, even the Quran can be read, but Jesus is there, he is infiltrating the world. Well, this is the ecumenical event, supposedly, that has the sanction of U.S. government and the U.S. president, and also becomes a sort of a week-long lobbying festival for foreign officials. One of the things that bothered me is when I looked at who was coming, the delegations from around the world, almost more often than not, it was led by the defense minister of small nations, Albania, Ecuador, and so on. And they're coming there to lobby. And the family is only too happy to help them do that in exchange for influence in their governments.
Is there anything you'd like to tell us about the Mark Sanford story or the John Ensign story that you feel like you understand because you've studied the family?
I was especially fascinated when Governor Sanford explained his decision not to resign by referring to King David and saying, look, here's King David, this guy who fell mightily, but he went on. And by fell mightily, he means that King David had an adulterous affair and then had the husband of the woman murdered. And that's actually one of the sort of core parables of the family that I encountered and described this experience where David Coe, the son of Doug Coe, the leader, came around and gave us this long lesson. He says, what made King David great? And the men I was with are all trying to say, well, he loved God, he all this. He says, no, that's not it. He says, King David was a terrible man. You know, he was an adulterer and a murderer. So why is he a hero of the Bible? And the answer is, because God chose him. King David is beyond morality and their limited understanding of Scripture. And that's a central parable in the family's thinking. And I could almost hear Doug Coe's voice when Governor Sanford is saying, I need to keep governing because I'm like King David.
Well, Jeff Charlotte, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jeff Charlotte is the author of the book The Family, which was just published in paperback. He also co-edited the new book Believer Beware, First-Person Dispatches from the Margins of Faith, a collection of articles from the website he co-founded, Killing the Buddha. John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, Babyface Nelson, Melvin Purvis, G-Man names from Chicago in the 1920s and 30s that have become the stuff of legend, especially Hollywood legend. They're back in the new action and love story Public Enemies, directed by Michael Mann. The film stars Johnny Depp as Dillinger and Marion Cotillard, who won an Oscar for playing Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The most powerful emotion in Public Enemies is Johnny Depp's love of being a movie star and getting to wear wide-brim fedoras and long black coats and spats and firing Tommy guns at G-men. And I ask you, my friends, who wouldn't love that? It's the coolest fantasy ever. And Depp is happily in sync with his role. His John Dillinger loves being a celebrity too, and loves that he can hide among the people who think he's a folk hero. At the start of the film, Dillinger and his cohorts break out of prison, and soon he's dressed to the nines at a nightclub and thunderstruck by the sight of a luscious, soft-curled Marion Cotillard. Cotillard's Billy Frichette joins him at his table, smitten back in a way that's highly credible, even if her American accent sinks somewhere in the mid-Atlantic.
What is it exactly you do for a living?
John Dillinger, Rob Banks. That's where all these people here put their money.
Why'd you tell me that? You could have made up a story.
I'm not gonna lie to you.
That's a serious thing to say to a girl you just met.
I know you.
Well, I don't know you. I haven't been any place.
Well, some of the places I've been, it's hot. Where I'm going, a whole lot better. You wanna come along?
Boy, you're in a hurry.
If you were looking at what I'm looking at, you'd be in a hurry too.
Wow, what a comeback line. Obviously, Depp's Dillinger is a romantic, which is what will bring him down. Former gang members tell him the age of the independent operator is ending, soon to be replaced by cold-hearted syndicates. If Public Enemies director Michael Mann has a moral point of view on Dillinger's bank robberies, which get a lot of people killed, I couldn't discern it. His central motif is a retread of the one he peddled in Heat, that Dillinger and Christian Bale's FBI agent Melvin Purvis, though on opposite sides, have a code that's distinct from their respective cohorts. Dillinger doesn't shoot anyone in cold blood, as opposed to Stephen Graham's Babyface Nelson, who cackles at his carnage. And Purvis offers a contrast to fellow cops who torture suspects, and most of all, to the power-grabbing, image-mongering FBI director J. Edgar Hoover, who's played by Billy Crudup in an astounding transformation, fatted and vaguely effeminate. Public Enemies doesn't really have a theme, but it has a tone and a tempo and a look, a palette that's fascinatingly weird. Mann shot it on high-def video, which is subtly different than film. Branches in a forest at night are so sharp they're like etchings on the screen, while the air itself seems thick, the perspective shortened. I think this look was better suited to Mann's recent Miami Vice movie with its druggy tropical haze, but the shootouts here work like gangbusters. The camera offers only limited vantages, and there's an eerie disjunction between the overbright muzzle fire and the gun's muffled pops, like distant firecrackers. High def does have one distracting downside. You can detect the male actor's pancake makeup, which is especially unfortunate in the case of Bale, who now looks, as well as acts, like a wax dummy. Public Enemies has lots of incidental pleasures, gorgeous costumes, an electrifying comeuppance for Babyface Nelson, a second escape from prison that's ingeniously staged. But it's only Depp's goofy sense of fun that keeps it from seeming inert. After Michael Jackson's untimely, though perhaps inevitable, death, I rewatched his music video of the song Smooth Criminal. It's a gangster fantasia with rat-tat-tat, staccato hoofing, and a touch of Guys and Dolls. It's everything Public Enemies isn't, madly inventive, genre-bending, at once a study in urban paranoia and a passionate tribute to the artist as outlaw loner. The video reminds you why the gangster became a pop culture existential hero. Under threat, Jackson seizes the space. Michael Mann's vision lacks that inner spark. He's made a period gangster museum piece. It doesn't dance.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.